From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Helen Rosner of The New Yorker tells us what made Anthony Bourdain such a special presence on television and in print. Then the new horror film Hereditary is being called the scariest movie of the year. The film's lead actress, Toni Collette, has a theory why.
I think this film is truly frightening because it has no hope. There is no light. There is no way out. These people are trapped, and they are doomed.
And the Tony Awards are on Sunday. We'll talk about what this year's nominees reveal about Broadway, both commercially and politically. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy-eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. For the second time this week, a major public figure has reportedly committed suicide. Following the death of designer Kate Spade, author, chef, travel guide, and all-around fascinating guy, Anthony Bourdain appears to have taken his own life in France. He was 61 years old. Even though we live in a television and streaming era where chefs and cooking shows are seemingly on every hour of every day, Bourdain not only was one of the first, but also stood apart from the rest. He was as much a culinary anthropologist as he was a cook, and he was also a gifted author. Helen Rosner is the food correspondent for The New Yorker, and she knew Bourdain well. When we connected by Skype, she described what made him a singular kind of celebrity.
I think that he is probably one of the most famous people on the planet. And yet, the way that he moved within his celebrity and the way that we perceived him as a famous person felt very human and very intimate. He was a real guy who talked like a real person and just kind of felt like the smartest of your friends who happened to have a really cool job traveling the world.
And I think a lot of people who understood the power of words and what he was doing in print and on television recognized that he was really interested in this idea of truth as a form of power. Why was that important to him, and how did it express itself in his work?
He was a man of remarkable clarity. You know, he was a fiction writer before he started writing the memoirs that became Kitchen Confidential. He was really interested in crime. He wrote an essay a couple of years ago called The Life of Crime, where he talks about the fact that the thing that was really interesting to him was that criminals were in on the secret, but only the people who are participating in it actually know what's going on. You have to be in the back room in order to know about the back room deals. And he took that idea of pulling back the curtain and really applied it to Kitchen Confidential, which essentially pulled back the curtain on what's really happening behind the white tablecloth veneer of a restaurant. And then again in his shows for the Food Network and for the Travel Channel, and most notably with Parts Unknown on CNN, going into places that we might only see in a very carefully photo-selected image in a travel story in a glossy magazine and saying, listen, here's what it's really like.
There's the Jamaica that most Jamaicans live in, cook in, struggle to survive in. The real Jamaica. Then there's the Jamaica which you're probably more familiar with.
His story is one of growth and forward motion and trajectory. He didn't just become famous and then sit back and rest in it.
You wrote about Bourdain in December of 2016, soon after the election of Donald Trump. And while talking to a chef about an election might seem weird, it wasn't. And you said in this story for Eater, I'm quoting your article now, food is politics is the point, more to the point, media is politics, and that includes food media. How did Bourdain fit into that idea of yours?
Bourdain was always resistant to the idea that his show and his work were inherently political. One of the things that Tony said in that interview was that he might not go into a place intending to have a political agenda or to make a political point, but if he's in a country where the military controls the farm production and controls the roads, then the military is controlling how the flour makes its way to bakeries, which means that every loaf of bread that you eat is touched by politics.
There's so many food and cooking shows and chef shows around. I think it's hard to remember what it was like before all of this started. But I want to go back to what he wrote in The New Yorker in 1999. He had submitted this essay, and I think to his great surprise, The New Yorker published it. It was called Don't Eat Before Reading This. And Bourdain talked about what chefs talk about. Here's what he said in part in that essay. Even more despised than the brunch people are the vegetarians. Serious cooks regard these members of the dining public and their Hezbollah-like splinter faction, the vegans, as enemies of everything that's good and decent in the human spirit. To live life without veal or chicken stock, fish cheeks, sausages, cheese, or organ meats is treasonous. What did he provide in terms of a glimpse into the life of a working chef that was really missing from the conversation at that point?
He was a man who spoke and thought and behaved in hyperbole, and that's a really powerful way to communicate. But the truth is that the world he was coming out of, the restaurants he worked in, the kind of cook that he was, there was heroin, there was alcohol, there was LSD, there was tons of marijuana. I mean, everybody was drunk all the time. It was not a pretty scene, but it painted a real pirate ship rock star kind of veneer onto the culinary world. And by using language like what you just read, by being so emphatic, by calling vegetarians Hezbollah, I mean, he forces you as an audience to sit up and listen.
He also used his fame to champion books by fellow chefs and people who wrote about food. He founded Anthony Bourdain Books. He published Daniel Vaughn's The Prophets of Smoked Meat, A Journey Through Texas Barbecue. And he made a deal with Chef Jose Andres for his book, We Fed an Island, The True Story of Rebuilding Puerto Rico, One Meal at a Time. How important was it to him that he recognized other chefs rather than be intimidated and fearful of them?
He was an extraordinarily generous man, and if you were a frequent watcher of his TV shows, you probably knew the names and personalities of his producers and his cameramen. He was never interested in being the only person in the spotlight, and the same was very much the case when it came to his role as a celebrity chef, and I'm putting that phrase in scare quotes because he always really rejected the idea that he was a chef. He tried to put his fellow restaurant workers to the forefront, whether that was someone like Jose Andres or someone like Wiley Dufresne, or whether it's the uncountable thousands of Mexicans and Latino workers who are working in restaurants all across America who never get the same kind of attention from the media or from the diners or from their communities as do the chefs whose faces are in the magazines.
Helen Rosner is a food correspondent for The New Yorker. Her article, Anthony Bourdain and the Power of Telling Truth, can be found on The New Yorker's website. Helen, I know he was kind to you. I'm sorry we've lost him. Thanks for coming on the show.
I'm really happy to be able to speak with you.
Coming up, one film critic says Toni Collette's performance in Hereditary is, quote, so raw it's as if she's being flayed before your own eyes. Collette explains how she got through it.
Anyone who ever had a heart wouldn't turn around and break it. And anyone who's ever played a part wouldn't turn around and hate it.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. And Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series. Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi. And Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The new film Hereditary is part family drama, part really, really scary movie. I actually saw and heard a grown man scream something like, whoa, in the middle of an early screening for the film. Written and directed by Ari Oster, the film is an examination of the Graham family and its secrets. Actress Toni Collette stars as Annie Graham. When we meet Collette's character, her mother, with whom she's had a strained relationship, has just died, and along with her husband and two children, Annie is trying to process the loss. Along the way, the family starts discovering a variety of bad things about itself. Annie connects with a mysterious woman named Joan, played by Anne Dowd, who is the terrifying Aunt Lydia in The Handmaid's Tale. One tip, if a character played by Anne Dowd is offering advice, best to ignore it. When I spoke with Toni Collette about Hereditary, I asked her if she thought parents might watch the film differently than people who don't have kids.
Well, I think Ari Aster, the writer-director, has been so clever in that the perspective kind of shifts in this film. So you really do get to know each of the characters and how they feel at any given moment. So, yes, much of the story is seen through my character Annie's eyes, and she's someone who has recently lost her mother. She has lost her brother. Her father has experienced some dark, ominous anxiety for much of her life and can't quite put her finger on why. And this is a story of her awakening and coming to understand some very deep, dark family secrets, which are totally inescapable. But there's also Peter, played by Alex Wolff, and Peter's Annie's son.
Is there something on your mind?
Is there something on your mind?
Just seems like there might be something you want to say.
Peter.
Like what? I mean, why would I want to say something so I could watch you sneer at me?
Sneer at you? I don't ever sneer at you.
Oh, sweetie, you don't have to. You get your point across.
He's going through his own evolution, learning to become independent, and he and his mother have a very contentious relationship, which is so much fun to play with. As an actor, but yeah, so basically I think there's someone for everyone to connect with in this movie, and there's a lot to be scared by in this movie, both in the classic genre element, but also just the family dynamics permeate this family in such a toxic and hideous way at times that that in itself is horrific.
I want to ask you about that genre idea, because so many of scary movies have what we call jump scares. It's a slamming door. It's something flying through the air. It's something kind of unexpected. And I would say that your movie, like A Quiet Place and Get Out, seem much more interested in character and performance than jump scares. So what does that mean in terms of working with your writer and director, Ari Aster, in terms of what you're going to do before you start shooting, or the conversations you're going to have with him about what this film is ultimately about, even if it's got scary moments in it?
There's no denying it. It is a scary movie, and it is, unabashedly a horror film. But I would not have been interested in doing it if it were more of a traditional horror film, because they seem to me to be somewhat gratuitous in the fear that it perpetuates. This film, when it was sent to me, they said it's a genre film. I know you're not interested, because at the time I was trying to do some lighter work. But I opened it up and I was kind of confused, because it was this kind of beautiful, very frank, raw, emotional, honest look at loss, at grief, and this family in pain, struggling to navigate through something that, you know, we'll all experience at some point or another. And I was interested in it because it felt truthful.
I didn't let her anywhere near me when I had my son, which is why I gave her my daughter, who she immediately stabbed her hooks into. And I felt guilty again. When she got sick, not that she was really even my mom at the end, and not that she would ever feel guilty about anything.
Ari's writing was so brilliant that I couldn't not do it. It was beyond my control. I mean, I just mentioned it before, I wasn't looking to do any heavy work, and that was because I was starting to feel that in some of the work I'd done prior to this film coming into my life, I'd always answer the question, do I take my work home with me or do I leave it at work? No, absolutely. It's completely separate. My life is my life. Work is work. But then I started to feel that I was accumulating a certain amount of kind of emotional gunk that wasn't mine. And so that's why I said, I want, romantic comedies and lightness and laughter. And so when it was sent to me, I really, really was not looking to do it. But it was so brilliant. It spoke to me on such a deep level. And it was truly surprising. And I know, as an audience member, that's what I want, not just as an actor. And it was exciting. So there was a part of me that was trying to figure out how to get out of it, but there was a part of me that knew that I had to do it. So I read the script when I was working in Europe. I spoke to Ari on the phone while we're in different continents. And, to me, it kind of felt a little like The Ice Storm. It just had this really confident, brave rhythm. It didn't feel like it was trying to satisfy anybody. It was its own thing, and it was unfolding in its own time.
We're talking with Toni Collette. Her new film is called Hereditary. You mentioned Ang Lee's film, The Ice Storm, and I'm curious, when you're meeting with your director and maybe department heads, the references that you're talking about, are they other horror films? Are they dark mysteries? Are they like really disturbing images? Or is it family melodramas like Ang Lee's film and things like that?
Well, it was very much both, because the film does straddle both worlds and it honors both genres. Ari often mentioned, I had seen Rosemary's Baby and he talked about Don't Look Now, but he also did mention The Ice Storm. So when I mentioned it to him in that initial phone call, he was like, wow, that's amazing. That is one of my references. But he's very clear to speak about the film in the phrase that he used. He said it's definitely a classic family drama which curdles into a nightmare. And, you know, I tend to, in my life, have gravitated towards films that have a certain amount of warmth and hope. I think this film is truly frightening because it has no hope. There is no light. There is no way out. These people are trapped and they are doomed. That's really
This is not a romantic
intense.
Comedy. If you're looking for a lifetime.
No, it's not what I was anticipating. Not what I was quite hoping for. But I tell you, it was one of the most profound, satisfying working experiences of my life. And on a person, like as an actor personally, given the fact that I was trying to avoid anything heavy, going to it knowing this is probably one of the heaviest films I would ever be involved in, I knew what was required of me, and I somehow managed to, you know, there was no other way than to, you know, it's my job to be as honest as possible with the emotions. I think everything in life is energy, and if the audience is watching it and they don't feel what the character is meant to be feeling, then they'll be taken out of the story. So it was very draining and very exhausting, but I found a way to take care of myself. I just suddenly realized this is just energy. You know, some emotions seem much more acceptable than others, and some people find others to be taboo, and it's just energy in the body. And once you start thinking of things in that way, I realized I had some control in that. So most nights you would have found me at the gym, because I was literally just jumping up and down and running on the elliptical cross trainer, just literally moving the energy out of my body and not letting it stagnate in there. So it was kind of good for me ultimately. And at the end, I don't think you would imagine I would have felt much more exhausted. I felt pretty good.
Actors can help find character through costume, through kind of a set. And I'm wondering, your character is an artist and she works with these dioramas that over the course of the film, without giving too much away, become increasingly gothic. And I'm wondering about working with these dioramas and the artists who create these kind of miniature models and scenes for you to work on as a character. What does that give you as an actor when you have these beautifully designed and created miniatures that you as an actor are working on, even as they become a little bit more and more disturbing?
They're so intricate and so lifelike, and they represent so much in the film, because it is Annie's work and it's her way of both controlling her world and exploring the world that she doesn't understand. I think Steve Newburn and his team, they also made the prosthetics in the movie. They're so talented, and sitting down to work with them for the first time, you know, I had those incredible magnifying glasses and that kind of wrist support, and I looked around and I was like, what do I do? How do I do this? And the thing is, I could have done it anyway, because everybody works differently. So they were like, just get into it, you know? So I just started, you know, painting and gluing, and there was always like a specific piece to work on for each scene that was chosen by the props department and Ari, essentially, because every decision is Ari's. It was part of the film that I loved. And it's a very big part of Annie's life. And there's a scene that's cut out of the movie where I smash up every single piece of her work, and the people who made all of those miniatures were standing there watching.
Oh,
and
my
I
goodness.
Could not have felt more guilty. My God. But they'd read the script. They knew what it was. It was just, everyone kind of chose their favourite piece before I did it. But it was fun to do too, because that in itself, that scene, and in the movie you see Gabriel Byrne's character coming home and finding me kind of sitting in the rubble of many, many, many months' work that I've ruined. And I think my character has gotten to the point, it's not, yes, she's frustrated with work, but it's also that she's really getting close to the truth about her life and she doesn't not want to look at it. So she kills it.
Toni Collette's new film is called Hereditary. It opens June 8th. Toni, thanks so much for coming on the show, and I hope you get a nap.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Hereditary is in theaters today. Coming up on The Frame, the Tony Awards are on Sunday, and one of the big questions is this: has Harry Potter put a spell on voters? The Tony Awards are this Sunday, the annual recognition of the best plays and musicals on Broadway. On the drama side, the big question is whether Harry Potter and the Cursed Child will overcome a Tony bias favoring plays aimed at adults. And in the musicals category, will voters choose one of the splashy pop culture adaptations? Those would include Frozen, Mean Girls, and SpongeBob SquarePants. Or will The Band's Visit overcome the odds? And then there are the revivals. On the drama side, they include Angels in America and, among the musicals, My Fair Lady and Carousel. To dive deeper into the Tonys, we connected with Jesse Green. He's a theater critic for the New York Times. And I started by asking him about the prospects for that play about some boy wizard.
I think Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, perhaps you've heard of this Harry Potter. He's a character from literature. He is likely to, you know, really wipe up a lot of the categories, particularly the design categories, but also everyone seems to be in agreement that that the play will win as best play. The competition is kind of weak, and none of the other plays up for that category are even open anymore, so it's really a pretty clear path to picking up the big award. And the only competition among plays in terms of number of awards might come from the revival of Angels in America.
So out here in Hollywood, it's no surprise that it's all brand names all the time, sequels, spinoffs, reboots, whatever you want to call them, and that the studios are making fewer and fewer movies. And it feels like something similar is happening on Broadway, that there are fewer shows that are opening, and there are shows based on properties like SpongeBob SquarePants. You mentioned this wizard boy, Harry Potter. But it also feels like those shows might have a little bit more art in them than, say, the latest Star Wars movie.
I think it's interesting to note that one of the things that's going on is that more shows, particularly big musicals, are lasting longer, which is good for their producers. But it clogs up the pipeline so that newer shows can't get into Broadway. The number of shows that opened on Broadway this season is far less than last year and hugely less than it was in olden days. So there's some categories barely have enough material to stock them completely. And that said, the one, especially in the musicals, the ones that are produced tend more and more to be these brand extension shows like on the high end of that, you get a SpongeBob SquarePants, which was beautifully imaginatively staged. And then you also, at the bottom end of the pile, you get an Escape to Margaritaville, the Jimmy Buffett so-called musical that I was not a big fan of.
So the Tonys are not always an illustration of what New York's theater community believes are the most relevant and urgent stories that need to be told. But if we look at the season as a whole, and maybe look at some of the shows that are up for Tonys, what stands out to you thematically?
Well, that's an interesting question because it is a little bit all over the map. What ends up getting to Broadway in any particular season is obviously not any one person's artistic decision. It's the result of millions of decisions by lots of people and, you know, where the money is. So you get everything from a revival of Angels in America, say, or equally fine, the revival of Three Tall Women, the Edward Albee play starring Glenda Jackson, whom everyone expects to win as Best Actress. And these plays are extremely serious and seem to speak to, being revivals, a need to reevaluate things that we thought we knew about ourselves as Americans and ourselves as human beings in light of recent changes, shall we call it. But then when you go over to some of the musicals we were talking about, it's hard to discern any particular message in the big brand extensions. Those just seem to have ripened at this moment as a result of their kind of the financial arc of that their properties. However, when you get to The Band's Visit, it doesn't in any way speak to our current political situation in the United States directly. But as a show that whose entire meaning is how do we communicate with people whom we have been taught to distrust, with whom we have no common language, in that sense, I think it's speaking to a terrific need that many theatergoers, at any rate, are feeling. And I hope that many of the tourists who will start coming if it wins Best Musical will appreciate as well.
In the era of Me Too and Time's Up, how did the revivals of My Fair Lady and Carousel, both of which are up for Best Revival, play, and did they feel a little dusty and dated?
Well, there was a lot of concern going in that these two shows, both from the so-called golden age of American musical theater, were going to be awkward in light of recent changes in our society and the conversations going on, as you say. Carousel has as its main figure a man who hits his wife, and My Fair Lady, of course, is the story of a man, or as it has been traditionally shown, the story of a man who recreates a woman in the image that he would like her to be. So both of these stories were highly susceptible to this sort of criticism. In the end, however, it kind of split. Carousel did not, in my opinion, adequately deal with those issues, neither embracing the tough story and presentational style that's built into the material, nor criticizing it. But My Fair Lady did a beautiful job of saying, okay, who is this woman, not just who is the man, who's usually more the focus of the show. And Lauren Ambrose, who plays Eliza Doolittle, has a wonderful arc in which you come to realize that it's really her story about her using him, that is to say the man who teaches her how to become more upper crust, how to become who she wants to be, as much as it's his story of wanting to make her who he wants her to be.
Jesse Green is the co-chief theater critic at the New York Times. Thanks for coming back on the show. Have a great time.
Thank you, John.
The Tony Awards air Sunday at 8 p.m. on CBS. That's tape delayed. So if you want to be surprised, don't check Twitter. And that's all we have for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, and Monica Bushman, with help this week from Jonathan Shiflett. Our interns are Maria Alexa Cavanaugh and Marcy Landgren, and our engineer is Valentino Rivera. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday.